I took an actual vacation day this week. And that, no. That's not me bragging about working too hard. That's me saying that when you're in the middle of grad school and working a full-time job, your days off tend to be whichever one has had less attention given to it. And so on Friday, our family went down to, we have a cabin in Virginia, and we went down there, and I spent all day there, and night, and we came back yesterday. And I completely unplugged, which was beautiful, and I read a book that wasn't theology, which is the first time I've done this in about 2 years. And so I started reading this book called North, and it's written by Scott Jurek, and Scott Jurek is one of the most prolific ultra marathoners in American history. He's won like the Western States 100. These are big trail races or big ultra marathons. He won it 7 years in a row when he was in his prime, a 100-mile long race. And so this story called North is a story of when he reached about 40, 41 years old, he started to not race as well in what he had been doing, and he didn't know what was next in his life, and he started to just have this question of what do I do with myself? And he got this idea that what he wanted to do was set the fastest known time, it's called FKT, for through hiking the Appalachian Trail, which is a 2,189-mile footway from Georgia all the way up to Maine. Traverses 13 states, or 14, one of those. And so this is his memoir of his journey of doing that, of trying to be the fastest person ever to complete these almost 2,200 miles. He has to do a little more than 50 miles a day on foot through really rugged terrain, which the East Coast isn't necessarily known for, but the Appalachian Trail is actually more rugged than other trails like the Pacific Crest and other trails in the West. Even though they're more mountainous, the grade is much smoother. And like in Pennsylvania, you just have rocks everywhere. You're like hopping over little rocks just to walk in a straight line. And so in the middle of this journey, he's thinking that it was going to be easier than it is. And he's only 8 days in, and that's where I'm at right now. So I'm right, the suspense is killing me. So I'm going to read more later today. But where he's at in this journey is he's already starting to get some injuries, and he's starting to wonder if trying to win is enough to keep him going. And so the question of purpose begins to come up in his mind. Because all of a sudden, when you're in pain and when you're asking the big questions, simply being the fastest doesn't feel like it's worth it anymore. And so the question that he's asking is, what is my purpose? And it's leading him into a much deeper question, and that is, what is my purpose, not just on this hike run on the trail, but what is my purpose, period? What am I all about? What are the things that will actually bring me the deepest level of meaning, value, and worth? So many of us, Christian or not, we walk through a really full life with responsibilities and with stresses and with a huge to-do list. And deep down, we are asking the question, how much of this is meaningful in the deep ways? How much of this meets the criteria of this is the purpose of my life? How many of the things that I do on a regular basis meet the this isn't the purpose of my life criteria? And when we ask those questions, our answers kind of leave us a little bit dumbfounded. They leave us wanting. They leave us answering strangely, I'm not sure a really high percentage of what I do each day fits into the category of this is the purpose of my life. And we wish we were doing more. How many of you, I'll let you define that exactly how you want. How many of you wish that you could do more? Okay. At some point in your life, I wish I could do more for this person, more of the adventures that I want, more blank, 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 blank. More what exactly? As Jesus followers, I guess the answer is to what more is more of what God wants us to do. I wish we could do more of whatever God wants us to do. To be disciples is to actually become more like Jesus. We are not simply trusting Jesus for salvation, but we are developing the character of Jesus, and we are learning to represent his action in the world. And his action is rather broad, because Jesus wants to redeem everything. This is the story that we have been given. Many of you are familiar with this. The story that we have been given is the story of redemption. The Bible that we have is a story of ongoing redemption. God creates people, and he creates people with this vision to live in absolute harmony and to live in intimacy with God, and to then work the world and rule over the world in the type of way that fulfills God's dream for what the world will look like. But along the way, people, they start to choose their own thing. They start to want to do their own thing. By the way, that's our friend Josh. He speaks sometimes. That's no problem, okay? Just so everybody else knows that. So what we have is we have this journey of people, and people begin to say, well, God, I know that you say this, and I know that you designed like this, but I think that this might be a little bit of a better approach. And so, and this is what we call sin entering the world. It's anything that moves away from obedience to what God's heart for the world is. And so there is this break, okay? It's called a curse in the scripture. There's this curse on humanity where people have this tendency to move their own direction. And the whole story of the Bible is God fighting and clawing his way back to reveal himself to us. Not in a coercive way, not in a way that says, this is what you must do, not imposing his will on us, but instead wooing us back through the power of love and grace, and calling out a better story than the ones that we often choose. So this is the story of redemption, God taking everything, creation, people, the relationships people have with creation, the relationships people have with each other, the relationships people have with God, and restoring the original worth. That's what we call redemption. That is the story. That is what happens all over the place. Okay, right now we're talking about, we're spending a few weeks reflecting on who we are as a church because we're embarking on some new adventures. And so we've been talking about our mission, and I realized there was a typo here last week because of a spell check error. So apparently we were all about God's receptive work in the world, which I have no idea what that even means. So sorry about that if you've been in some kind of a spiritual quandary all week long wondering what it means to participate in God's receptive work in the world. But our mission is to make communities of disciples who reconnect people to Jesus, to one another, and to God's redemptive work in the world. These are the three things that will lead us to the most full expression of what it means to be disciples, okay? And so today, we want to talk about what it means to reconnect people to God's redemptive work in the world. The final part of our mission is quite explicit, that God is at work. God is purposeful. God doesn't simply exist. God's doing something. He's got a mission. And that mission, like we talked about, is to redeem everything. Jesus comes onto the scene, and Jesus' work is twofold. Number one, in a mystical, spiritual sense, it is to experience and absorb the power of sin and death, which are linked, and break it down, because of his willingness to die an unfair death and to absorb that sin that has stained the world. Secondfold is Jesus examples for us what it looks like to live in a way that restores God's worth to the world. Jesus examples for us what it looks like to live as the archetypical human. I think Paul calls it the second Adam. A new example of what it means to be a person. And so then we look at this as disciples and we say, okay, following Jesus then is how we begin to work toward making the world more like what God's dream was. So we have a role in all of this. And that's, sometimes it can feel like a big task. And what we talk about a lot is the little moments. We learn that even in the little moments, we have opportunities to participate in God's redemptive work. I'm going to call them today. I'm going to just say, we have these day-to-day opportunities that are redemptive, okay? So these are the times where you are talking with a family member or a coworker or your children, and you realize that you have an opportunity to help make things right and restore in just a little way what God's heart looks like in the world. So you choose to forgive. You choose to speak value and worth into people's lives. These are the moments of just right in front of us all the time. Opportunities for us to work toward God's redemption. Okay? And that happens typically. We have opportunities all the time, whether or not we go looking for them, for day-to-day redemptive action, becoming a great neighbor. There's just opportunities all over the place. Okay, But then there's other stuff, and this is not day-to-day stuff. This is stuff that requires us to move beyond our normal lives into something bigger, okay? To move, and so what we're going to call it is out-of-the-way redemptive work, all right? So we've got the day-to-day stuff that we talk about a lot, and we get the out-of-the-way stuff that we're going to talk about a little bit more this morning. And this is the stuff that pulls us to dive into something out there in our world, and we don't always know what on earth to do with that. There's a story in Mark 6. You're probably familiar with it. The story is about Jesus with his disciples after quite an intense few days of emotional ups and downs through a variety of things that we won't get into right now because that's not the point. But Jesus landed. They had been on a boat crossing over to the other side of the Sea of Gennesaret, and he lands and he sees a large crowd. And it says that he has compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he does what Jesus does, is he changes his plan in order to be obedient to God's heart. And he begins to teach them, and he teaches them all day. And then the day starts to get late. And when the day starts to get late, the disciples come to him. This is a remote place, they said. It's already very late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. Jesus, give them a break. We know that you're, you know, speaking good stuff, but we've all got our limits. And these folks are tired. And what they probably meant is that we're tired, right? You know how this works when you're hungry. I do it all the time with my wife. Honey, I'm sure that the kids are just ready for dinner. Like, we should really, you know, get our dinner plans worked out. And so I'm guessing the disciples maybe had a little bit of an ache in their stomach. Send the people away so they can go. It's great. It's so compassionate, these disciples. They are just always considering others first, aren't they? So send the people away and they can go find something to eat. But Jesus answers, you give them something to eat. They say, Jesus, here's a problem. Jesus says, you give them something to eat. And that's the moment, isn't it, that we get too overwhelmed by. The moment when we look in the scriptures and we see the way that Jesus starts talking about what it means to be a disciple. Jesus comes onto the scene and he proclaims that he has come to bring good news to the poor and freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind and freedom from oppression. He heals people of diseases. He cares for the outcasts and the overlooked. He offers spiritual life to those who are aware of their own deadness. He begins to make a new world called the kingdom of God. Call it into being, enact it. He's doing all of these things. And then the disciples are called to come and do the same thing, to come and join him in it. He says things like in John 14, I tell you the truth, anyone who believes in me will do the same works I've done and even greater works because I'm going to be with the Father. Is this not a little bit overwhelming for us to think about? Jesus looks and he says to his disciples when there's 5,000 people that are hungry, hey, you give them something to eat. Jesus tells his disciples near the end of his life, hey, I tell you, anyone who believes in me will do the same works that I have done and even greater works because I'm going to be with the Father. And we try to call bull, right? And we say, this is just, like, these are the scriptures that we just prefer to just keep mysterious and not deal with because we just don't believe them. We just don't believe them. And so this is what we do. We say, oh, boy, it's just a mystery. And so we just avoid having to deal with scriptures that talk about us doing greater things than Jesus. And so we become just stuck. We just become stuck. We hear Jesus say, you give them something to eat. And our response is, that would take more than a half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat? The first response that we have is assumed impossibility. And by no means should we read this response to Jesus' question or statement of you give them something to eat as a viable option. This was not what they were saying. They weren't saying, okay, so what do you think about this idea, Jesus? Should we go and buy? This was an incredulous response. This was saying, so what are we supposed to do? It's going to take more than 6 months of work. We're supposed to spend everything that we have. I don't even know if we have that much. Have we checked? Are we going to all use it? We're just going to blow it all right here? They're going to be hungry again tomorrow morning. This is not a valid potential response that the disciples are going after here. This is saying, Jesus, that's a terrible idea. We can't do this. This is too much for us. Okay? And so this is the nature of it. And so we simply say, what do you mean, Jesus? You give them something to eat. The question of the type of things that we are supposed to do as Jesus followers is actually not that ambiguous. It's fairly clear. Then the question is, why do most of us have so much trouble identifying one way that we are going out of the way to participate in God's redemption of the world? Why do most of us have so much trouble even identifying one way that we go out of our way to be a part of God's redemptive work, if so much of what Jesus taught and called was to do that? Let's ask all of you. It's time to poll the audience, although you're not an audience. Okay, so take out your phones, if you've got one, and we're just going to get an idea of where we're at as a community here real quick. So here's what you're going to do. If you've got your phone, open up your text messages. Don't look at the rest of them. You're just going to write a new one for us right now. Don't get distracted. And so what you're going to do is you're going to text, and the person that you are texting is 22333, okay? That is the address that you're about to send a text to, 22333, okay? And the word that you are going to text is all one word, LifePath598. And that gets you in. It's as easy as that. It's on your little handout. Where are we? Yep. So once you text LifePath598 to the number 22333, then we become aware that you are in. And once you are in, all you have to do is simply respond with the letter A, B, C, D, E, or F. Why is it difficult to find a redemptive work right now? Why do you think it's so hard to say, in a clear way, yes, here is how I am going out of my way to join Jesus in the redemption of the world, in participating in the redemption of the world, going out and doing something. Why do we have so much trouble getting into this, figuring it out, doing it? Maybe because it feels too little. I'm just going to have such a small impact. It's not going to make much of a difference. Maybe what you feel drawn to feels just infinitesimal. Maybe it feels too big. How am I going to change the entire reality of racism in the United States? It's just too much. Maybe you feel ill-equipped. You just know that you don't know. Maybe you can't figure out which thing is your actual calling because so much of your life, it's been like, well, you have to get it right. And so you have all these passions all over the place. You're interested in so many things, and it just paralyzes you because, wait, which one is God actually calling me to do? Maybe it's my life is simply too crazy right now. Do you know what I live like, you're thinking? I have children. I have family pressure. My work is crazy. I have health problems. My life is just not in a position where I can kind of go out of my way and focus on anything out there. Or maybe it's something else, which it looks like one of you said. So, we have kind of a mix here, which is good. Because if nobody responded to one of them, it wouldn't be helpful to actually address it. So thank you for playing our game. Why do we struggle so much with these problems? Why, when we look at Jesus walking with his disciples and inviting them to give people something to eat, why are we so quick to say, but Jesus, what you're suggesting is simply impossible. It's just too much. So many things give us pause before finding some real work to do in our lives, even when most of us would admit that we think this might be among the most important things that we can spend our lives doing. I think the reality is, deep down, whether or not we'd admit it, we actually think Jesus has left us alone to do this stuff. Deep down, whether or not we would ever say it, I think that we believe that when we are called to do redemptive work in the world, when we are called to participate in God's dream for relationships with one another, with the systems of the world, with God, to look like God originally intended it, to work toward that end goal, we really, deep down, we believe that God, Jesus has just said, here, go and do this. Go and give them something to eat. Figure it out. We hear those words and we think Jesus is asking us to do something that is unfairly beyond our scope, bottom line. And we make excuses and we offer up all the reasons that we don't think it can happen. I want to go back to the story that I mentioned earlier with Scott Jurek. What I didn't say is that in the midst of a journey to accomplish something that nobody has ever accomplished before, in terms of the amount of time he wanted to do this Appalachian Trail through hike, what I didn't mention was the relationship that he has with his wife, Jenny. Jenny is the head of his crew. When someone does a fastest known time attempt like this, here's the thing. They are the ones that have the tracking device on their foot that everybody can follow online. They're the ones that the magazine articles are written about and everything like that. But you know what? They can't do a thing without the fuel that gets them the energy each day. And that fuel is provided by your crew. Your crew follows you around in a van, hitting up with you at different intersections along the trail, giving you food, giving you dry socks, helping you change your clothes, giving you muscle wraps for when you pull something, and everything like that. And Scott's wife, Jenny, he calls her J-Lou, and she calls him Jerker because he's a Minnesotan and he's super nice. And so his nickname is Jerker. So they still, after being married for a decade, they still call each other by their nicknames and not by their actual names. They're a unique pair, but sorry, that's aside. My wife told me when I tell stories, I give too many extra details. So J-Lou is actually the one who is making this whole thing possible. And Scott, in his memoir, works really hard to make sure that we understand that while his feats are the things that are being noticed, his actions are the things that are in the forefront, it could never, ever be possible without the reality that she is providing all of the fuel and most of the inspiration that keeps him going, and that this whole thing is a complete partnership. This whole thing could never even remotely be possible. She is actually the glue and the thing that is making it happen. He wouldn't get 4 days of running 50 miles a day without her. And so this idea of someone else providing the foundation is similar to what we find in our relationship with Jesus. Here's the secret. Jesus never intended his disciples. And by the way, some of you are going to be like, well, I knew that. Jesus never intended his disciples to do this on their own. Accomplishing the mission was always intended to be done in the context of powerfully trusting Jesus to do the heavy lifting. It was always a partnership, always. This is such great news. Let's go back to some of these stories and see how it comes up. But Jesus answered in Mark 6, you give them something to eat. They said that would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat? Obviously the answer is no, according to the disciples. Jesus, how many loaves do you have? He said. He asked, go and see. When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups in green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties, taking the loaves and the fish and giving thanks. He broke them. Then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the fish up among them all. They all ate. They were satisfied. The disciples picked up 12 baskets of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of the men who had eaten was 5,000. Now here's the thing, when I look at this story typically, what I think and what I've thought for much of my life is that he says, you guys figure it out. I want you to do things powerfully. And they say, well, we just don't have the faith or we just can't. And so Jesus says, fine, just bring it to me. I'll take care of it. I always thought that it was a failure on the disciples and that Jesus then took over. As I sat with this more, what I realized is that this may have been Jesus' plan the entire time, all the same. And what was missing was the nature of the response from the disciples. What was missing was the disciples simply saying, instead of, we could never do that, that would take more than half a year's wages, Instead, just imagine the disciples saying, okay, where do we start? And Jesus continues on. Well, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And the only difference is the disciples saying, okay, where do we start? Look at how much they are doing. So Jesus directs them. They have the people sit down. They pass out the food. They collect the food. They are actually feeding the people and giving them something to eat. They still do it. I always thought that when Jesus says, you give them something to eat, when they fail at their response, that they didn't actually give them something to eat, that Jesus had to take over. That's not actually the case. They still gave them something to eat, yeah? It was just that Jesus knew that this was going to be a partnership, and from all along, the plan was that he would be the one empowering it and making it happen. What did he think? That they were going to do what he just did? Not yet. Not without his Spirit. And so anyways, we often miss how much partnership, even in these moments, Jesus has with his disciples. We often overlook. Jesus is explicit about this stuff in John 15. I love this passage. I no longer call you servants, Jesus says. This is right after talking about how he is the vine, and he talks about the Father and Jesus being connected. And then he talks about how the disciples should be connected with him like branches. And then he says, I no longer call you servants because a servant doesn't know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends. But business, by the way, the Greek word there is literally, it's just work. Because a servant doesn't know what his master's ultimate goals are, what his master's really working toward. Okay? But you, I call you friends. For everything that I've learned from my Father, I've made known to you. And then he says, remember, you didn't choose me, but I chose you and appointed you. I sought you out to be partners in all of this so that you might go and bear fruit, right? Go and do stuff, fruit that will last. And so whatever you ask in my name, whatever you ask according to the character of Jesus, and remember what the nature of we totally mess this up. And by messing this up, by the way, we've taken all the power out of it. We've taken all the, by saying, whatever you ask for my name in my, and I'm going to, hopefully I won't offend some of you here, but when we say, whatever you ask for in my name, the Father will give you, we do this name it and claim it. Well, I'm just going to ask for whatever, and I'm going to say, in the name of Jesus, I'm asking for this in the name of Jesus. That is not what we're talking about here. And so we know when that doesn't happen, we say, oh, I guess that was maybe contextual, or it just doesn't work anymore. I don't know why, I plugged the right code in. What Jesus is saying is that when you ask for things in my name, a name in Hebrew culture was a character that represented something much deeper than a person. It represented the nature of who they were. So Jesus says, when you ask for something in my name, according to my character, which is what my heart is for in the world, when you ask for the power to forgive, when you ask for strength to continue to work toward transformation in the world, my Father will give it to you because the kingdom is continuing to come. And this is my command, love each other, we're not going to stick with that one because I talk about that like every week. But that is the foundation of where this power comes from, is that their love for one another is how the love of God is made known in the world. It's so encouraging. It's so beautiful. It's Jesus saying, hey, you no longer work for me. You work with me. Do you understand that? Paul uses the word a slave of Christ because he is trying to break down societal norms at the time, okay? He's trying to say that the people in Paul's positions who were the evangelists and the apostles, they would have had a prime, especially in Greco-Roman society, would have had a prime place in the speaking places. And so when he identifies himself as a doulos or a servant, when he does that, he is trying to break down this hierarchy. But we actually sometimes can blow it by talking about ourselves as slaves of Jesus when Jesus says, no, you're co-workers and you're brothers and sisters. So we need to be careful that we understand how and why we talk about serving Jesus in the ways that we do. Jesus has a higher view of us than we often have of ourselves, yeah? Okay, important stuff. So the good news is that Jesus' partnership here, it actually addresses every one of the issues that you mentioned earlier. So let's pull that poll back up, see if it's still there. All right, good. If you feel like, oh my goodness, my idea, it feels like whatever I'm drawn to do is too little, or if it feels like it's too big. I want you to hear in John's version of the feeding of the 5,000, I want you to hear what Andrew's response was to all of this when he said, when they found the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. And this is in John 6. I'm not going to put it up here because I want you to keep this up. Another one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. Here's a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish. But how far will they go among so many? That's the question. He says, but how far will they go among so many? My gifts are limited. My time is limited. The resources here are limited. So how far will it go? I feel like what I am trying to do feels too small, or what I have to give feels too small. And that is the statement. And I love it because it's just great writing by John, the gospel writer, because John knows that that question is such a great kind of preamble to the work of God. But how far will this go among so many? Like, what good is this? What good could this possibly be? How far will they go? It doesn't matter what we have to give if Jesus is the stronger partner in the journey. It doesn't matter how little we have to offer or how small we think our impact is. Some of you that I've talked with said, well, here's what I really feel drawn to, but it's like one person. It's offering compassion to this person. I know some of you have spent hours and hours and hours caring for people who have significant needs. And sometimes it'll be weeks and months of care for one person, and it just feels too little. Is this me doing God's redemptive work in the world? Because it feels pretty small. Yeah, it is. Because Jesus is your partner, and Jesus multiplies things. Now, what about if it feels too big? Well, that was the whole story that we just got done with. How far will this go among so many? Well, Jesus can take what we have and work with it bigger because Jesus is partnering with us. It's not that bad. I feel ill-equipped. Okay, another challenge. But once again, God's the one doing this. In John 14, I already told you about the scary quote. I tell you the truth, anyone who believes in me will do the same things I have done, and even greater works because I'm going to be with the Father. And so here's the follow-up sentence to that. Look at this. You can ask for anything in my name, and I will do it. Look at the language. So that the Son can bring glory to the Father. Yes, ask me for anything in my name, and I will do it. Do you see this? Do you notice this? I will do it. I will do it over and over again. I will do it over here. Terrible with my handwriting. I'm not trying to cross it out. I will do it. I will do it. You can ask for anything in my name. So he says, you can go and do glorious and amazing things. You know this, right? The reason that Jesus says this is because when he goes to the Father, he sends his Spirit. And now all of a sudden, Jesus' Spirit embodies hundreds and thousands and now millions of people in the world. So Jesus says, you're going to be able to do way more than what I could do. I was in one place at one time in one point in history. Now, sky's the limit. Because my Spirit's been given to all of you. It should inspire us. So if you feel ill-equipped, just remember that it's not you doing all the work. Jesus is shouldering the burden. Okay. If you can't figure out which thing to do, this one's a legitimate one. I almost promise you that if you've got this idea, you grew up in the church. Because the church has created this angst. How many of you that grew up in the church and went to college had some amount of fear about choosing the wrong school, that God had picked a school out for you and you were going to get the wrong one? Some of you grew up, yeah, okay, so maybe 5, 6 of you. Some of you grew up in this world. It is terrifying to think that even though I want to glorify God with whatever I do, I may pick the wrong thing and my life is going to be destroyed. That is not how this whole thing works. Yes, God can certainly direct us in very specific ways. But if we don't feel that specific direction, it doesn't mean that pursuing God's heart in a certain direction means that you're going to get it wrong. Can you imagine God as a loving Father saying, I know that you spent your life counseling children that have trauma, but man, I wanted you to work with homeless families. Come on, friends. Come on. The kingdom is big. God's redemption is needed all over the place. So let's stop being paralyzed by the idea that we might not get it right. If it's not a good fit for you, you will figure it out, and God will lead you in a better direction. And in the meantime, you'll be doing God's work. So praise God for that. Okay? So God will give you guidance, and if God doesn't, pick something. All right. Sorry. I believe that God guides clearly. I just don't believe that God, you know, paralyzes us so that we never do anything with our lives because we're worried about getting it wrong. Just, if you're a parent, just think about that with your children for a minute. Just think about that. That's ridiculous for us to think about God like this. All right, my life is so crazy right now. Last thing. When we are involved, I can't really address something else. When we are involved in God's work, truly working toward compassion, redemption, helping connect people to God's heart, to God's grace, to God's restorative work in the world, to God's redemptive action. When we are doing God's work, there is an inversion that happens. Pouring out becomes what sustains us. You might think you have no time and energy for this. Pouring out, though, becomes the thing that sustains us, because you are literally spending time with Jesus, if we believe that we are partnering with Jesus in this. I don't like talking about this. Lately, I would have what I characterize as a high-stress life. There's a lot of things going on, and I get overwhelmed quickly. And when I'm at my most overwhelmed, because I feel like I just don't have enough time to accomplish everything that life demands, you know what my wife tells me? Go run. Go for a run. I'm a runner at my core. I don't often do it these days because I've been too busy. And when I'm the most busy, Bethany shakes me. She says, go for a run. Get your life together, man. Because she knows that when I actually go and connect with part of who my core is, that I actually then have the capacity to handle the rest of it. That is what participating in God's work does for us. It pouring out becomes the thing that actually sustains us long term. It's a reversal of our assumptions. This is what makes everything else work in our lives. Going out and saying, I am going to actively find a way to love my neighbors. I am going to actively participate in working for God's justice and redemption and reconciliation in the world. That is what actually brings us enough life to help do all of the other things that we have to do. So, don't let the craziness of life make you think that somehow Jesus can't use you for redemptive action out of the way. Community matters here too. We mentioned that we have these priorities, our connection to Jesus that helps us hear holy stirrings, our connection to each other is how we flesh out what those stirrings are. We ask each other those questions over and over again. How are you going to go out of your way to partner with God's redemptive work in the world? How are you practicing it day to day? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? Don't give up. That's what community does. Okay? Our hope as a church is that within a year, we want to be able to have every single person who calls LifePath home to say, here is how I connect with Jesus on a regular basis. Here's my spiritual formation practices. Here's my one another. Here's how I am actually in real relationship with other disciples growing. And here is my redemptive work. Here's what I'm doing in the world to participate in God's bringing of the kingdom. We want people to use that language. I want you up here during story space saying, so my redemptive work is blank, 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 blank. We want you to be able to have it so clear that you can actually grasp and say, here's what I'm doing. We have three compassion teams at LifePath. Two of them are working with Family Promise, and one of them is working as mentors for the school here that we will start in about 2 weeks, I think. Hopefully those of you that are signed up have gotten some emails, but they're getting it going. I just talked with the director. And so those are things that are formal ways to participate in God's redemptive work here. There's a ton of other ways in your own lives that you might be doing. Those count. We want to bless those things. We don't say the only way that you can participate in God's redemptive work is if you do it through us. In fact, we're going to claim it when we find out what you're doing, by the way. We will say, that's ours. That's ours. Jess is a great example. We claim Riley the Brave, Jess's book, to help children deal with trauma. That's us, because she is us. And so we claim the redemptive work that we are doing, and we say this is what our church is called to do. So it's beautiful, but it doesn't have to fit within our boundaries. In fact, some of you might not have the capacity for adding another thing on because part of your life is already doing that. Great, we want to equip and encourage you in that. Okay, I've talked too much. Anne Frank said, how wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. How wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. I would add, how wonderful that we don't need to be capable of changing the world in order to change the world. That we have a partner that's stronger and more powerful that we can trust. There is more to be said, but I'm not going to.